himself. But now, he recalled General MacArthur and Daniel, and in the same way, put his arms firmly around his wife. He turned her to the mirror that was opposite the sculpture of Mary, and held her there. She looked at herself, at her twisted face, and at Francisco's tear-lined face, and at Mary and her owls behind them both, reminding her what the Sorias were really meant to do. Minutes passed like this, with Francisco still and Antonia rigid. Antonia's anger died inside her. She collapsed against Francisco, and for several minutes they wept together.
"Look at us, Francisco," Antonia said. "Look what we've become."
Francisco pressed his lips together.
"I don't want to. I'm too ashamed."
Daniel's presence in the shrine was so potent that they found themselves speaking English, as they would have if he'd really been there with them. They realized it at the same moment and shed more tears.
"What can we do?"
"I don't know. I just don't know."
They clung to each other still. Judith had thought that if she convinced them to dance on the stage as they had when they first met, her mother and her father would fall back into each other's arms, and she was not quite wrong. But it was not the 100th blow of wind to knock the barn over, merely the 99th. This place, the shrine, reminded them of who the Sorias really were. To turn away from this calling was to ruin themselves. Francisco and Antonia were both so choked up with unperformed miracles and their own darkness that they had nearly destroyed themselves. In this way, losing Daniel's parents had begun to tear them apart, and in this way, losing Daniel brought them back together. Outside the shrine, they could hear owls shuffling and calling, sensing the presence of a looming miracle. In this case, the untended darkness inside both Francisco and Antonia resonating against the unused saintliness inside Francisco. But they were not pilgrims. They were Sorias, and they had both seen for themselves that Soria darkness was a harder thing. Both thought of the wooden Soria family housed in another shed nearby, of Daniel, lost in the wilderness.
"We cannot orphan our daughters,"
Antonia said wildly. The door to the shrine flew open. Both Antonia and Francisco jumped in guilt and shame.
"Rosa," Antonia said. "Rosa, I can explain."
But Rosa Soria, her round and beautiful form lit by headlights behind her, was there neither about the owls on the roof nor Daniel in the desert.
"Come to Eduardo's truck and listen to the radio," Rosa said. "Tell me who it sounds like to you."
It was inevitable that the other Sorias would hear the radio station eventually. In past years, when the family had stayed up late enjoying one another's company, it would have taken no time at all, because the assembled members would have noticed the cousin's absence. But because the Sorias had slowly parted, falling into their individual sadness, it took a late-night trip to uncover the secret. Eduardo and Luis had gone to Alamosa to play cards and on returning had seen the pilgrims gathered close together. It looked like a witch's gathering, with Tony the giant at their center, a fire pit at his feet. Although he was married to Judith Soria, Eduardo Costa had an outsider's understanding of the pilgrims. This meant he usually did not think of them at all. And when he did, he thought about how they were uncanny. He thought about his wife's family's legendary history in Mexico, and he thought probably this proved that God was real, and if not God, at least the devil. Up close, they made him uneasy, and so it was with suspicion that he drew his beloved stepside truck close to them. When he exited, he realized the pilgrims weren't truly gathered around Tony or the fire. The real focal point was a radio.
Hola, 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 it is Diablo Diablo again, tiptoeing through the night with just 15 volts and a dream. We've got a great show for you tonight. Our theme is gonna be love. I know what you're saying. The theme for every night on this show is love, Diablo Diablo. But I don't mean love like that. Not a kissing and a hugging, my friends. We're talking love like for your mother, for your brother, for your sister, for your auntie. So what have we got? What have we got coming up? I've got some love letters. Not love like that. Not love like that. You wait. That listeners have written for me to read on air. I've got another entry from my cousin's journal. And I've got some fresh new music shipped in from a friend back east who's got an ear for what's hot. I know it's late, but stay tuned and stay awake, because here we go. Let's get underway with a classic from Trio Los Panchos.
Eduardo instantly recognized Diablo Diablo's voice. Joaquin, he thought. His fancy and useless 16-year-old cousin by marriage, a disc jockey. Eduardo was no fool, and he had heard some pirate radio in his time, and he knew at once that that was what he was listening to. Because Eduardo was a proper macho of the kind who was much prized at the time, and because a pirate radio carried an element of risk to it, this raised Joaquin's esteem in Eduardo's eyes by several degrees. Before, Joaquin had been merely ridiculous to him, but now Eduardo revised all of the memories he had of him to include his role as a pirate DJ. Now, his strange sense of fashion seemed like a coy nod to Joaquin's secret life. His hair was a wink. Eduardo was an old-fashioned cowboy. Joaquin was a radio cowboy. This was to change their relationship for the rest of their lives.
"Where is Joaquin broadcasting from?" Judith asked.
"Shh," Nana hushed.
All of the adult Sorias listened to the broadcast. Because the cousins had taken every other radio in Bicho Raro, this meant they were assembled in and around Eduardo's pickup truck. Rosa and Antonia and Judith and Nana were crushed inside the cab, huddled together for warmth. They did not want to turn on the heater in case the blower would drown out any of the broadcast. Francisco and Michael and Luis perched in the truck bed. They were cold too, but they suffered it alone. Eduardo sat on the hood and smoked a cigarette. He did not believe in suffering, so he felt plenty warm. Diablo Diablo said, "Here's a letter from an anonymous listener. He says, 'People always said I was lazy, a do-nothing who just took up space. My sister always thought the best of me, and I feel a little bad for letting her down. She always thought I was going to turn out to be something, and she used to cuss at anyone who said otherwise. And it's too bad that I didn't turn out to be something, because I feel like all her cussing was for nothing. Of course, maybe she would have cussed anyway.'" The Pilgrims had written the letters. This was one of the ideas Tony had suggested to Joaquin during the course of the afternoon. Tony, after all, had first-hand experience with how well listener participation could boost a radio station's success. The two of them had gotten along as well as two folks could when all communication had to go through a young man from Oklahoma, particularly when they discovered they both loved the same part of radio, the intersection of music and stories. Diablo Diablo continued, "If she were listening, I'd tell her that I really needed her cussing. I guess it didn't make me do anything, but it made me happier while I wasn't doing anything. Maybe one day I still will be somebody. Maybe." "Sounds to me like this anonymous listener needs some gas in his engine. Luckily, I've got just the thing. I just heard it today, and I haven't been able to stop listening to it since. Here's the brand new Loco Motion by Little Eva. Let's get moving." A mixture of emotions filled the space around the radio in Eduardo's truck. Shock, anger, delight, pride, and finally, as owls began to circle the Pilgrims, anxiety. Unperformed miracles hung thick in the air, and the birds were going mad with it, swooping and calling, feathers drifting all around. There were second miracles choked up in the pilgrims and first miracles in the Soryas.
Let's have another pair of letters from two more anonymous listeners. Remember, those of you pricking your ears to us from home, the theme for tonight is love, and these are love letters. Letters about all the strange kinds of love we feel for our family and friends. While you're listening to these words, friends, think about what you would tell these anonymous writers. Would you give them comfort, advice, agreement, or maybe just a swell little song from the Shirelles? You know what? I'm gonna spin that, and we'll be back to read the letter on the other side.
The Soryas said nothing for the 2 minutes and 38 seconds it took the Shirelles to ask if they would still love them tomorrow. They waited with rapt attention until Diablo returned with the letter he had promised.
I don't know if I love my sister or if I have to love her because we're basically the same person. People are always saying we look alike. It's the first thing they say. Then everything else is measured by comparison. You're actually a little taller than your sister, or she ate more than you, or you read longer books than her. Nothing ever happens, it's just about me. I guess that makes me selfish, so that's stupid. I'm glad these are anonymous.
Have you ever felt like that, listeners? Like you only exist in relation to someone else in your life? It's a terrible feeling. People are like sweet, sweet chords. We love them when they're playing all together nicely, like in the pretty number I'm going to spin next. But it would be a crying shame to forget what a lovely little noise a D major makes strummed on a single guitar. All of the Soryas in Eduardo's truck imagined themselves first as part of the Sorya song, and then as individual chords. All considered that the song they had been playing collectively was not a very harmonious one. Diablo continued.
Hold that thought. I'm going to read this second letter now because it's also from a sister to a sister. I love my sister, but I also hate my sister. We fight all the time. She knows everything about me and I know everything about her, so we don't really have anything to talk about. We just fight. Sometimes I pretend that I've gone out and gotten myself a very exciting life with exciting friends, and at the end of the day I'll come back to her and be able to tell her all about it, and it will be nice again. But I'm too afraid to do that, actually. She likes me because she has to like me. What if nobody else does?
Nearer to the fire, Robbie and Betsy were squirming a little. They were the authors of these twin letters, of course, and it was hard to look each other in the eye, hearing them read out loud. It is often easier to be truthful with yourself and others in writing, and that was the case here. Diablo said, "I've got a song for these two sisters, but I've also got a piece of advice. I know what you're saying. Nobody asks you or your mama for advice. I know it, but it's not from me or your mama, it's from Frida Kahlo, offering some truth to everyone out there who can't let go. Here's what she said. Nothing is absolute. Everything changes. Everything moves. Everything revolves. Everything flies and goes away. Sisters, I want you to think about that while I sing you a song that's a lot about love, but also just a little about liberation. Here's Brenda Lee's Break It to Me Gently." As Brenda Lee began to croon through the speakers, Francisco suddenly put it all together. The radio, the letters, the owls swooping overhead. He said,
"The pilgrims are the listeners. They wrote the letters."
And now, for the first time, the Soryas were directly answering their questions.
Chapter 24. Because Beatrice's mind was a busy and practical thing, she had played over the possibility of her family discovering the radio many dozens of times. She had considered all sorts of possible outcomes, both positive and negative. She had prepared herself for Joaquin's unbearable smugness if he received a compliment from any of the family. She had developed persuasive arguments for why the radio was probably not truly a bait to the FCC here in the wilds of southern Colorado, where the radio waves were not worth enough to send city folk out to take them back from young pirates. She had decided how she would describe the building of the radio to her father so that he would be delighted by the process. She had considered how to defend the use of the otherwise pointless box truck in this way. But she had not ever, before that night, thought about how she might defend herself after breaking the most serious rule the family had. She had not thought about it because, before Marisita, Joaquin and Beatriz had not ever used the truck in such a way. And before Jenny, they hadn't realized they were going to do it again. Beatriz was not particularly a rule breaker, as she didn't mind following a rule as long as it didn't get in her way, and she didn't get into arguments, as she never raised her voice, and she didn't interfere with other people's lives, as she herself didn't like to be interfered with. So, she was not used to being in trouble. The last time she had gotten in serious trouble had been when she'd been born, because she was supposed to have been a boy. Alejandro Luis Soria was the name both Francisco and Antonia had chosen for her, and Antonia had imagined her to be a garrulous and dashing man, like Antonia's father had been before he died early in a freak airship accident. Francisco had imagined her as a clever and intelligent scientist, assuming thoughtlessly at the time that only a man could be so rational. Everything else since the shock of her femaleness at birth had been minor dispute in comparison. So it was not a consequence that readily occurred to her when predicting the future. But now, she was in trouble. As soon as the truck pulled back into Bicho Raro and parked, its lights turned off for secrecy, figures appeared in front of the truck like spirits. All of the Sorias had turned out to confront Beatriz and Joaquin and Pete. Beatriz had never seen their faces the way they looked tonight, not even when they were looking at Daniel's message to Marisita. She understood now that this was not going to be about the disobedience of a pirate radio station. There was a taboo, and it came with real consequences, and Joaquin and Beatriz were experimenting on the ragged edge of it.
"Do you hate us?" Rosa said.
She had believed that Joaquin had broken the taboo the moment he read the letters out loud from the sisters, and now was crying from fear and relief on seeing that he was unchanged. Merely disobedient, not lost to darkness.
"Why would you play with this, Joaquin? Like it is nothing, when Daniel has lost everything for the same price."
Joaquin stood frozen. He had been suspended in the high of the show. He had thought it was good while he was writing it, and he had thought it was even better with Tony's notes, and he had thought it was very good when he recorded it. But when he heard it broadcasting from the radio, he had thought that it was great. And he was not wrong. He was still suffused with the powerful sensation of doing exactly what he had been designed to do. This was his miracle, and he was drunk with this electric holiness. For the entire drive back to Bicho Raro, the thrill and correctness of it had left him unable to contemplate anything else. So when he found himself confronted, he could not think of what to say. It was too opposite to how he had just been feeling.
"And you!" Antonia said to Pete. "I trusted you and thought that you respected my family. Instead, you're throwing us into danger like we are nothing."
This struck Pete hard, as everything she said was true, both the good and the bad. He had passed messages between Tony and Joaquin all day. He had coordinated the Pilgrim's letter writing. He had come along and pounded ground stakes into the ground and helped Beatriz to erect the ever-taller antenna and then hurriedly packed it all back up again when they were done. He had known from the beginning of his time here
that the Sorias were not to interfere with the pilgrims. And yet, he had let himself be used, joyfully, gladly, as a conduit between them. He was as guilty as the cousins.
"I want you gone at first light," Antonia said. "This is unacceptable. How could I trust you again?"
Beatriz could bear neither Joaquin's expression nor Pete's expulsion. She said,
"It was my idea." "But why, Beatriz?"
Judith asked.
"It was a calculated risk,"
Beatriz went on, already knowing how these words would sound to her family before she said them. Daniel's decision had been a calculated risk as well, and now he was gone.
"We thought there had to be a better way."
"And what if it had come for you, Beatriz?" said Francisco, and she knew he was angry because he spoke this instead of whistled it. "What if the darkness had come upon you while you were out in the desert performing this secret experiment, this calculated risk? What if Judith came to look for you and also fell prey to it, and then your mother came to look for you and fell prey to it, and so on and so forth? Did you calculate that?"
Beatriz did not say anything. She had thought about the possible consequences, but not in that way. That first night with Marisita, she had offered to send Joaquin away if he was afraid, because she knew the risks. If she had brought darkness on herself, she would have done exactly the same thing as Daniel and exiled herself in the desert and made sure she was not found. She was very good at puzzles, and she had been certain she could make one out of her location if it had come to it. Judith would never have found her. Beatriz weighed the benefit of saying all of this out loud and did not see any value to it, so she said nothing.
"How can you not believe in the taboo after what happened to Daniel?" Antonia asked.
The true answer was that Beatriz believed in the danger, but she didn't believe in the taboo. She weighed the value of saying this and found this also useless to say out loud. She thought that by so doing she was improving the situation, but anyone who has held an argument with a silent participant will realize that silence sometimes can be more frustrating than a defense. This was the case with the Sorias and Beatriz. They grew more upset and said more things to both cousins while Beatriz merely listened. The more she listened, the more distressed they became, and the more distressed they became, the more she was certain she could not truly make them feel at ease with her decisions. She did not know how to apologize for a rule that she had broken after considering the risks, because although she understood why they were angry, she still was not sorry that she had done it. She understood only that she could not tell them this truth, or they would be even more upset.
"Don't you want things to be different?" Joaquin said finally.
He was only 16, but in this moment he was the Joaquin he would become instead of the Joaquin he was. He was the man who would be Diablo Diablo in a bigger city, a voice to pilgrims in the night.
"We spend all of our time hiding in our houses when we see a pilgrim walking by. We see them suffering, and we say nothing. We smell Marisita's cooking, and we are too afraid to even tell her that it smells delicious. We starve. We starve of everything, because we're too afraid to eat. Look at us, all standing here, because we're afraid of them. That's why you're here, right? Fear."
"And where is your cousin Daniel, Joaquin?"
Rosa demanded. She had not called him anything but Kino since he was a child, and now he recoiled from his true name, although any other time he would have welcomed it.
"We are not afraid because we are cowards,"
Antonia said.
"Do you think we love him less than you? He is our son. He is our saint."
The grief in her voice was no greater than the grief any of them were feeling.
"We thought..." Joaquin said, and stopped.
He could not be logical and even-tempered.
"Beatriz, you tell them."
Beatriz said,
"We think the radio is making a difference.
Jenny made progress yesterday after listening to the radio. She can speak in lyrics. Tonight's program was for the twins. If they are changed by the radio, and we are still safe after broadcasting, then we found a way to help heal them without causing danger to ourselves. We could help pilgrims move on so that they would not feel bicho raro for so long.
We're building a lodge, Michael said.
We would rather have a lodge than our children turn to darkness from stupid risks, Antonia added.
Beatriz persisted with the most important part.
We thought if we found a way to help pilgrims, we could find a way to help Daniel.
Now, everyone was as silent as Beatriz ordinarily was.
Beatriz, Francisco whistled sadly, finally.
But she didn't want his pity. She had merely been stating the truth.
Daniel wanted us to think harder about this, she said. He wanted us to think about why we do the things we do.
Hand me the keys, Michael said, to the truck.
But Daniel,
Joaquin protested,
he's listening. Remember the message?
They all remembered the message. Now it was agonizing to all of them.
Please, Joaquin went on, we can't stop or he won't have us to listen to. He'll be alone.
Judith began to cry softly over the impossibility of it. Michael held out his hand.
I'm thinking about my family, who are not yet lost, and that includes you, my son. Now give me those keys, and do not make me take them.
Please,
Joaquin said again, and he too was near to tears. The sound of his voice, and indeed all of their conversation, was nearly drowned out, however, by the commotion of owls. Every Soria there knew what the birds carrying on meant. They were whipped to wildness by a miracle. The family searched the sky and the ground for the source of the owl's enthusiasm, but they saw nothing but darkness.
Joaquin, said Michael.
He did not want to carry out his threat of taking the keys by force, but Joaquin had not moved to give them. So he started toward him. At the last moment, Beatriz stepped in front of Joaquin and relinquished the keys. No one felt particularly victorious. There is no joy to be had in defending inaction and fear. The owls soared over the family into the night, and Bicho Raro fell into an unusual quiet. A feather floated past Beatriz. She could have caught this one, but she did not stretch out her hand. Out of the quiet darkness, two figures approached. They were silhouetted by the bold light of the truck headlights. Every Soria ceased what they were doing to watch them approach, because a process of elimination proved that they must be pilgrims, and they were.
Stay back, Antonia warned them. You know better.
But the pilgrims kept approaching. It was the twins, Robbie and Betsy. All of the adult Sorias recoiled. The night felt dangerous and unusual, and it seemed like anything could happen, even pilgrims attacking them with their very presence, intentionally violating the taboo.
Don't worry, Robbie said. We're just going, Betsy said.
Going where?
Demanded Antonia.
Home,
Betsy replied, because they were no longer pilgrims. Days before, when Pete had arrived, the girls had been tangled together by a snake that wouldn't allow them to live separate lives. Now, the snake was gone. Instead, they were merely girls standing side by side, close, but not close.
You killed the snake, Joaquin said.
No, Robbie replied. Well, kinda. We decided to together, but as soon as we decided to, it just disappeared, Betsy said, while the owls went crazy.
Their decision to work together to be apart had set them free.
It worked, Joaquin said. Beatriz, it worked.
And this was yet another miracle the Sorias had not witnessed for a very long time. Hope. All of the Sorias, Beatrice and Joaquin included, immediately found their eyes drawn to the shrine where Daniel used to be, where Daniel should have been. Michael handed the keys back to Beatrice. Chapter 25. Buildings are not very good at remembering the people who once occupied them. The high alpine desert around Bichoraro had more than its fair share of abandoned buildings, and Marisita was slowly working her way through them. Every time she thought she had searched all of the buildings within easy distance of Bichoraro, she found another one. They came in all shapes. There were collapsed barns, of course, like the one the Soria scavenged wood from, and old mining towns like the ones Pete and Beatrice had chased Salto through. There were equipment sheds and well houses. But there were also real houses, scattered homesteads, substantial cabins with porches and forgotten histories. Marisita was always shocked by how little she could learn about the people who had lived in them, even though some of them had been neglected only for a few years. Fabrics and rugs faded to colorlessness, glassware and knick-knacks got smashed, and scents disappeared. She had heard that houses like these used to be lived in by families who were bought off by logging companies or terrorized into leaving by white ranchers, but she had no way of knowing for sure. She found it depressing, how fast memories were replaced by rumors. Tragedy left behind such subtle artifacts. Marisita climbed through yet another empty house the day after the radio station had stopped being secret. This one had a front door. Sometimes they didn't, but it was missing the knob. Scavengers, both human and animal, had already had their way with the interior, so only a few featureless chairs remained, knocked on their sides. There was no bed, but it would have been a good place to seek shelter from the cold overnight.
Daniel?
Marisita called. There was no reply. There was never a reply. Marisita checked all four of the rooms anyway, in case Daniel couldn't speak or was dead. When she returned to the dim entry room, she carefully righted all of the chairs, attempting to return the room to as close to perfection as it was capable of. She looked at them for a long moment, trying to imagine what kind of family would have sat in them, and then she sank into one of the chairs and cried. Water pooled around her feet and slipped between the gapped old floorboards.
"Please be alive,"
Marisita said, but only in her head. After a few minutes, she rose and took up her bag from beside the front door and left the house behind. She wanted to be back in time for the radio program. Tonight was different than all the other nights, because now that the Sorias knew Beatrice and Joaquin were running a station, they insisted that the cousins broadcast live from Bichoraro. The single-minded goal was to reach Daniel, and the whole family wanted to be there to watch. Marisita had a letter in her pocket from Beatrice. It was probably soaked through, but she remembered what it said, as it was so brief.
Marisita, I hope you will consider completing your interview tonight. Beatrice.
But Marisita's heart had not changed. She still did not want to tell her story. The thought of saying it out loud made her feel as ill as the days when her past had unfolded. And every time she relived the memories, her tears came fresh, and the rain fell harder on her and her butterflies. She thought the Sorias already probably despised her for luring their saint into darkness. How much more would they despise her, she thought, if they knew what kind of person she was? She thought about the last thing Daniel Soria had told her, and remembering it reddened her eyes again, as it always did. She loved him and missed him, and she scanned the bright horizon for signs of him. There was no sign of Daniel.
only another small house, a twin to the one she had just searched. There was a story that linked those two houses together, but it had disintegrated with the curtains. The front door fell off as Marisita opened it, startling a thread snake, also known as the blind snake, from beneath it. The dust that rose in the air reacted with the storm over Marisita, so that electricity crackled. Marisita waited for it to calm, then she stepped inside. There was no furniture in the main room. There was only a shrine to the Virgin of Guadalupe in the corner. Marisita crouched before the statue. Mary, her eyes softly downcast, as gentle as Danielle's, stood upon a crudely sculpted pile of yellow roses. The words, "No estoy yo aquí, que soy tu madre," were painted among the blossoms. The rain from Marisita's miracle speckled the ceramic, giving the appearance that the Virgin wept. Marisita closed her eyes and meant to pray. But instead of a prayer, she thought about the lost stories of these abandoned houses, and about Danielle, and about the struggling Soria family. She thought about how a careless or foolhardy saint could all too easily reduce Bicho Raro to yet another one of these abandoned homesteads, a badly placed conversation sending deadly darkness through an entire family. Danielle had put them all in danger, despite his best efforts to separate himself, because he had somehow forgotten how tenacious love was, even in the face of fear. She had seen it before she left that morning. His family was still afraid, and yet they rallied around hope. She removed Beatrice's letter from her pocket. It was soaked, but the ink had not bled. Beatrice's request remained intently bold. Marisita knew that her fear of sharing her story was selfish. She had seen how music had helped Jenny, and she'd seen how Diablo Diablo's subtle exploration of the truth had helped Robbie and Betsy defeat their darkness. It was entirely possible that telling her story could help Danielle. They didn't know what he needed to hear to defeat his darkness, but they knew what he wanted to hear. Marisita. And yet, she was here, because it was easier for her. She had been fleeing her past for months, and she knew in her heart that this had become just another way of fleeing. The sculpture of the Virgin had ceased praying, and was instead holding her ceramic hands out toward Marisita. With a sigh, Marisita folded Beatrice's damp letter before draping it over the Virgin's hands. Marisita made a vow. If she did not find Danielle that afternoon, she would return to Bicho Raro, and she would tell her story on the radio. Only a few minutes later, she discovered Danielle's lost pack of supplies. It was hung up on a strand of barbed wire, just a few threads tangled around one of the barbs. Marisita ran to it as if it might run away, and she caught it up in her arms. It still smelled like him, like the candles of the shrine, and she held it to her face until she could feel the fabric growing saturated by the rain over her. Then she opened it and searched its contents. To her distress, she found it was full. She guessed, correctly, that this meant that he had not meant to leave it behind.
"Danielle!" she called out. "Danielle, can you hear me?"
Marisita found a hand-sized stone, which she set on the top of the fence post closest to her, so that she would have a marker of where she had found it. Slinging the pack across her shoulders in addition to her own bag, she began to walk the fence line, looking for evidence that a young man had squeezed through. Back and forth she went, in ever-widening circles. Her mouth had not been overly dry before she found his supplies, but now all she could think about was lowering her bag from her shoulder and taking a drink. She refused to, however, imagining how dry he must be, feeling selfish for knowing that she could take a drink at any time. She knew he might already be dead. She knew he might have sent out that message to her in vain. She called his name again. She did not know that he could hear her. Daniel was perhaps 100 feet away from her, still curled by the brush that he had sheltered under before. When he heard her voice, his heart leaped and then fell. He longed to let her find him, to hold him, to drive away the creature that still accompanied him. He imagined her pressing her fingers to his eyelids, as if his blindness was a pain that she could ease through touch. He could hear the rain falling around her still, and the sound of that water nearly drove him to weakness. But instead, he mustered his strength. Slowly he crawled around the opposite side of the plant in order to remain hidden. Marisita came closer, calling. Although Daniel did not want to be found, his heart cried for her so strongly, and her heart cried for him so strongly, that she was pulled inexorably in his direction. Only feet from him, her pulse pounded so strongly that it was as if she had already found him.
"Daniel," she said, "I'm not afraid."
This was not true, but she wanted it to be true badly enough that the difference did not matter. There are many kinds of bravery. The one Marisita displayed right then was one of them, and the kind that Daniel displayed was another. Everything in him wanted to call to her, but nothing in him gave in to the impulse. He had risked everything in order that she might live without her darkness, and he would not give that up just because he did not want to die alone. Marisita hesitated. She believed that her desire to find him had invented the feeling of certainty inside her.
"Daniel?"
The saint remained hidden. Marisita returned to Bicho Raro to tell her story. Chapter 26. Lightning and love are created in very similar ways. There is some debate over how both lightning and love form, but most experts agree that both require the presence of complementary opposites. A towering thundercloud is full of opposites: ice and positive charge at its uppermost point, water and negative charge at its base. In electricity and in love, opposites attract. And so, as these opposites begin to interact, an electrical field develops. In a cloud, this field eventually grows so powerful that it must burst from the cloud in the form of lightning, visible from miles away. It is essentially the same in a love affair. The night that Marisita agreed to finish her interview, the air felt remarkably charged, prepared for either lightning or love. The wind was full of words not yet said, miracles not yet performed, and electricity not yet discharged. All of this interfered with the station's signal. A test signal from their new broadcasting site, Bicho Raro, had traveled poorly, and even when they retried it closer to where they ordinarily broadcast, the signal remained weak. The atmosphere was simply too uncertain. Beatrice sat in the back of the box truck, the doors open wide, looking out at the familiar sight of Bicho Raro at sundown. The truck was parked beside the stage Pete had built. Wires snaked to the ground poles and to the antenna fixed to the truck's roof. Another cable led to where a microphone sat in the middle of the stage. Beatrice could see several sorias from where she sat, and well beyond them several pilgrims, including Tony's towering form. Very few people enjoy trying to solve a problem with an audience, and Beatrice was no exception. Moreover, the instability of the atmosphere seemed to be mirrored inside her. This was because her self-inflicted puzzles had previously had no time limit and no stakes, and this puzzle had both in spades. It was also because she had seen Marisita return with Daniel's bag, and she knew as well as Marisita what the loss of it meant for her cousin. Her thoughts were as turbulent as the air. Ideas refused to come.
"There's no point broadcasting into a void," Joaquin said.
He sounded dramatic, but it felt warranted. There seemed little reason to encourage Marisita's confession if Daniel had no chance of intercepting it. Pete, as ever the willing go-between, told Joaquin, "Tony said that you need height for your antenna."
"Height?" Joaquin said. "Yeah!"
But this information was not useful to Beatriz. She had known from the beginning of the radio project that she needed height. It was the simplest way to improve reception. This is why professional radio antennae soar hundreds of feet in the air and require blinking lights to prevent aircraft from having unexpected trysts with them. Their antenna had never posed any such threat to aviation. Beatriz explained to Pete that she had reached the extent of her antenna building capacity and did not know how to improve it, although she was willing to hear suggestions.
"Hold tight," Pete said, and jogged back to where the pilgrims loitered.
The mood there, gathered around the radio and fire pit, leaned closer to anticipatory than fearful. With the twins healed and Jenny well on her way, it felt as if the spiritual weather was finally breaking. Theldon had not picked up a paperback novel all day, and Jenny had listened to the radio and cooked in Marisita's kitchen while she was out. The resulting casserole was unimpressive in comparison to Marisita's elegant creations, but the enthusiasm in it tasted plenty savory for the pilgrims, and Jenny had added several new songs to her repertoire. For his part, Tony found himself filled with the satisfaction that comes from seeing someone else do well, or in this case, hearing them do well. Joaquin had done far more with his suggestions than he had hoped, and now Tony's vicarious ambition ran ahead of him. He imagined inviting Joaquin back east, getting him in front of microphones, watching his star rise. In this bright future, Tony imagined Diablo Diablo doing well enough that Tony could quietly retreat from the public eye and produce for him instead. It was an appealing image. So it was a Tony triumph full of philanthropy who told Pete,
"I can hold the antenna. I'll stand on that dish and hold it like Lady Liberty."
This might not have been such a relevant suggestion if Tony hadn't been a giant. But he was, making him 14 feet more useful than anyone else in Bicho Raro.
"That'll do it?" Pete asked. "Kid, me plus that dish will get that station heard through this whole valley," Tony said. "That saint of theirs won't be able to avoid us unless he got in a car."
Or died, thought Marisita, but she did not say it out loud. Since she had returned, she had watched the occupants of Bicho Raro prepare for the broadcast that night with growing anxiety. She attempted to pray in the shrine, but it only made her more overwhelmed. She tried to cook some dessert to follow Jenny's casserole, thinking the routine would settle her, but her hands would not cease shaking enough to hold the instruments of cooking.
"Marisita," Padre Jimenez said as the sky turned full black, "come with me."
She followed the coyote-headed priest. She expected him to give her priestly wisdom, something about believing in herself because our Father and Savior did. Instead, he led her silently to the edge of Bicho Raro, and there, in the dark, he simply embraced her. Marisita had been held only once in recent memory, and before then, not for months. And so the force of simply being held was enormous. She stood quivering in Padre Jimenez's arms until she stilled, and Padre Jimenez tried unsuccessfully to not enjoy the embrace as much as he did. Perhaps that does not take away from the original intention of the embrace, as Marisita accepted the offering as first presented.
"Gracias, Padre," she said.
"Of course, Marisita," he said, and licked his lips over his sharp teeth as he said her name. Are you ready?
Marisita looked to the stage.
It was decorated as if for a birthday celebration, with flags and lights strung between the upright stands. A small umbrella protected the microphone from her stormy presence. It would have been a fine setting for the beginning of a love affair, or for the reunion of a couple long separated. But she supposed it was also a fine setting for a night supplying comfort to a dying young man. She smoothed her hair, cast her eyes over the watching owls, and tried not to think about all the saints who were listening.
Yes,
she said.
Chapter 27. It was 1955, and Texas was drying out. It had started drying out in 1950, and would keep it up until 1957. But in 1955, they didn't know that it would have an end. It just seemed like it would go on forever. Dust drifted over driveways and highways and filled swimming pools and elementary schools. Crops turned to black ash like a biblical punishment. The dry-eyed sky stared down as farmers burned the needles off cactuses so the cattle could eat them. Students held hands with each other on the way from the school to the bus so they would not lose each other in the dust storms. If you were the sort who liked to sing sad songs, you sang sad songs. If you were the sort who liked to stay alive, you moved to the city. Marisita's parents were the sort who liked to stay alive, and so, when she was 9, they moved the Lopez family to San Antonio from the ranch they had worked on for Marisita's whole life. There were 6 of them, Marisita's mother, Maria, and her father, Edgar, 3 younger sisters, and Marisita. There was also Max, the oldest brother, but he was sometimes not quite like family. They traded the house on the ranch for an apartment in an old hotel. Even though it was still dry out there in Texas, in the city, it was a different picture entirely. San Antonio was a modern city of 500,000 people. There were shopping malls, race courses, subdivisions, highways bustling with cars. There was water. In the river, in the old gravel quarry, and in ponds in the cemetery Marisita passed on the way to school each morning. On her way home, she'd sometimes see boys fishing in the cemetery.
"What are you trying to catch?"
she had shouted once.
"You, baby!" one of them shouted back, and Marisita didn't ask after that. There was less drought to be found in San Antonio, but there was less money, too. It was expensive to live in the city, and Maria and Edgar both worked 2 jobs to afford the apartment. Max was probably old enough to work, but he couldn't. He got angry very easily, and Maria and Edgar told Marisita and her sisters that Max was working it out with God. God didn't seem to be working through it very quickly, however, and so the Lopezes had to do without Max's income. They managed, though, and Marisita made friends and taught herself how to be as perfect as she could. In 1956, Elvis Presley came to San Antonio. He was scheduled to play at the San Antonio Municipal Auditorium, the building where Edgar Lopez worked as a maintenance man. It was not as rewarding as working on the ranch, and Edgar was a lesser version of himself than he had been, but it was a paycheck. Or at least that was what Edgar told himself as he moved ever more slowly in both his body and thoughts, worn to ordinariness by the slow-motion tragedy of life. Edgar didn't complain about his fate, but the truth was, years of doing what needed to be done and nothing else was getting to him. He was getting old. In 1956, the King of Rock and Roll was pretty near the beginning of his career, quite a bit further away from the slow-motion tragic end of his own life, and San Antonio was unprepared for the newfound force of his fans. The plan had been for Elvis to play two shows and then sign autographs for any interested listeners. This plan was trampled by the 6,000 girls who queued up hours before the show and then refused to leave after. "We want Elvis!" they chanted as Elvis fled into his dressing room. "We want Elvis!" they chanted, lining the halls until forced to leave. "We want Elvis!" they chanted outside, as Elvis waited them out in the now-empty arena. He played a few tunes on the pipe organ while reporters and Edgar Lopez listened. No one had seen anything like Elvis before Elvis, especially an older man like Edgar Lopez. A man who never went to concerts. A man who worked two jobs at an ever slower pace. The show was non-stop action. Elvis sang, danced, played the guitar wildly, and gyrated his hips in a way that made Edgar avert his eyes, and some mothers cover their children's eyes. Elvis was tireless. No wonder the girls screamed, Edgar thought, because they were witnessing a rock and roll saint. But if Edgar had only experienced the show, nothing would have changed for Edgar himself. The show was memorable, yes, but not life-changing. But that combination of events, which led to Edgar and Elvis being together in the performance hall once everyone else was gone, was life-changing. Because Elvis was trapped in the San Antonio Municipal Auditorium long after his show, Edgar got to see him while not performing. While waiting for the girls to leave, Elvis sat at the organ, picking out Silent Night without any particular craft. It was this that moved Edgar. He would not have been prompted to action by Elvis performing, because Edgar could tell himself that Elvis wasn't real. But seeing Elvis afterward proved that this was indeed the work of a man. Perhaps an extraordinary man, but nonetheless a mortal like Edgar. Edgar decided he would no longer live his life in his diminished state. He would become, like Elvis, the loudest version of himself. And so that night, after Elvis had finally gone and Edgar was cleaning up after the horde, he sang a bit of Blue Suede Shoes and jogged up the stairs of the municipal building with renewed vigor. He was much older than Elvis, and much less practiced at vigor, so he caught his foot sideways on one of the steps and fell all the way to the bottom, breaking his leg. This was the beginning of the failure of the Lopez's fortunes. Edgar's leg never healed correctly, and so his job prospects shrank. He spent many days in the apartment with his leg propped up. The weight of earning fell upon Maria Lopez's shoulders. Many women would have been crushed under this newfound responsibility, but Maria Lopez became an enraged lioness in the face of bad luck. She got a third job. She bought Edgar a radio to listen to on his leg's bad days. She joined the newly founded PASO, Political Association of Spanish-Speaking Organizations, and campaigned fervently for better governmental representation, better health care and labor rights. Years passed. The Lopez family scraped by. Then, the 1961 San Antonio Stock Show and Rodeo happened. Each year, the show opened with a Western parade, and every year, the parade grew grander as the show aged. That year, the stock show, already large, gained new fame when Roy Rogers and Dale Evans, the King of the Cowboys and Queen of the West, starred in a nationwide NBC telecast featuring the rodeo. Hundreds of cowboys trotted through San Antonio, the horses wearing fancy bridles and turquoise-crusted breastplates and elaborately tooled saddles with metal-plated horns, and the riders wearing white cowboy hats and fringed shirts and beautiful boots. Convertible cars followed them with local and national celebrities waving from inside. Marisita, who by then had grown into an elegant and near-perfect teen, took her three younger sisters to see the parade. Edgar and Maria had been planning on going, but Edgar's leg was having one of its bad days. Max had initially come with Marisita and the girls, but anger took him before they got there, and he stormed away into the crowd.
Maria stayed with Edgar in the apartment, listening to the sounds of the music